The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, well, we are here with Francie Hakes.
So excited to be with Francie Hakes.
Francie, welcome to the Martinis and Murder.
Oh, thank you, guys. I'm excited to be here. I'm sad that I'm remote because it means I don't get a martini, but I'm happy to be here nonetheless.
Well, we're excited to talk to somebody who's an expert in the field because John and I are just civilians. We're just mere mortals, and
absolutely,
we're excited to talk to someone who's not a muggle. Just shout out to Harry Potter
Harry
for
Potter.
John there.
That was exciting.
Come on now. I'm a Harry Potter fan, so I knew what you meant.
There we go.
Sounds like we have a third host of the show.
Yes, you're in. That was the test. Francie, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Sure. I was a state and federal prosecutor for almost a couple of decades. I started off in the state system and prosecuted lots of different kinds of cases, but specialized in crimes against children, both physical and sexual. And then after about 6 years, I went to the United States Attorney's Office, where I became a federal prosecutor, and again prosecuted a variety of cases, but specialized in technology-facilitated crimes against children. I also did some counter-espionage and counter-terrorism work with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and my last 3 years at the Department of Justice, my job was to oversee the nation's efforts to fight child exploitation, to testify before Congress and do reporting and lots of training and try to improve the government's response to child abuse and child exploitation.
That sounds absolutely incredible.
It was, I was very fortunate in my career. I got to meet lots of interesting people, run around the White House for briefings, and like I said, putting myself in the position that I've had lots of other people in and testify a couple of times was a real interesting experience for me.
Francie, tell us about your podcast, because Darren and I were guests on your show and now you're a guest on our show, but tell our listeners what's up with your side of the podcasting world.
Yeah, well, thanks, John and Darren. I am a co-host of the podcast Best Case, Worst Case with former FBI profiler Jim Clemente. And we take our listeners, we hope, behind police lines with our interviews of all of our friends and colleagues, former and current, about how notorious, infamous, or interesting cases have impacted them in their careers. We're trying to take a little bit of a different tact. Of course, we talk about the facts of cases, what happened, what were the outcomes, but what we're trying to do is talk about the human side and the kind of emotional impact on the justice professionals working inside the system.
That sounds so interesting. We love your show. I've listened to a few episodes. I know Darren has as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's you know, as I said before, John and I are just kind of true crime fans. And so you've devoted your entire life, career, to this type of field. How did you become interested in this in the first place?
Well, you're going to laugh, and I'm definitely going to date myself, especially with you two. But when I was 5 years old, I was determined to become a lawyer and a prosecutor because I would watch Perry Mason reruns now.
Oh, not my only. Gosh. Yes.
I would watch Perry Mason reruns with my dad. And I always wanted to be Hamilton Berger, who sadly was the prosecutor who never won a case. But he always was very ethical and did the right thing. And it was a very collegial relationship he had with the defense attorney. And I just admired him so much and determined to be him. And I wanted to be a prosecutor specifically and do crimes against children. I think that was sort of established for me when I was in college. And I read a terrible article about the rape of a very young girl who was so traumatized. This was back in the 80s, was so traumatized by what happened to her that there was no way she could have ever gotten onto the witness stand in the courtroom with her offender. And because DNA was in its infancy then, they could not prove that he had sexually assaulted her, and he walked free. And,
wow.
You know, I'm sure you guys understand because you talk about murder all the time, and you can understand why even a case that you're not involved in really rouses your passion. And that one definitely roused mine. And I said, that's it. That's what I'm going to do.
So by the age of 5, you knew what you wanted to be when you grew up.
I did. I know that sounds crazy, but it's absolutely true.
I believe
no,
you.
I can relate to that. I completely understand. It's just interesting, I think, especially because you chose, I would say, probably the most disturbing of all the particular fields that you could probably choose. But child exploitation, I mean, how do you sleep at night?
Gosh, Darren, you know, that's actually a great question. I struggled with it my entire career. I still struggle with it. And I used to tell people that the hardest thing I would ever have to do was look into the eyes of a child who's telling you their story of abuse and promise to get justice for them. That, in fact, was not the hardest thing I ever had to do. The hardest thing I ever had to do was look at child pornography. And those images don't ever leave your mind. And you're looking at these images that are a crime scene depicting the worst moments of a child's life, and frankly, the worst moments of man's inhumanity toward man, and or in this case toward child. And most of the time you never know who they are. They'll never be identified. I have looked at hundreds of thousands of these images, and I remember them all. And the worst part is not knowing what happened to these children and not being able to be the prosecutor to seek justice for them, I think, was the hardest thing. And you're right. It makes it hard to sleep. Even now, I've been out of the business for 5 years. I left the Department of Justice in 2012. I still do a lot of speaking and training on the topic, but it's not something that you ever forget. You just have to compartmentalize it. That's the best I can explain it. And gallows humor, which I know you guys know a lot about because Martinis and Murder has lots of humor, really helps.
That's great. You know, we had our executive producer and narrator of our show, Snapped, on Oxygen on our show, and we asked her a similar question. She's done, I think, 20 seasons of Snapped and
300 episodes,
yeah,
or something.
And
crazy.
We asked her the same question, and her advice, or her coping mechanism, if you will, was watching goat videos on YouTube. So feel free to take that and run with it, and hopefully that can help you in some capacity.
Thank you. I don't think it's goat videos that will do it for me, I must admit, but it is usually trips to the beach where...
Perfect, yeah.
Maybe a martini, perhaps,
yeah.
Might
There's
help.
Definitely a cold martini in that beach vision, for sure.
Well, we have 30-some episodes with recipes in them. You can catch up on them if you would really like to get some inspiration.
Thank you, definitely.
Absolutely. Well, on this episode of our show, of the podcast, we're talking about Johnny Gosch. A lot of people obviously know this from the documentary Who Took Johnny? You know, and speaking of this child sex exploitation, you know, the main theory, the one that a lot of people have been running with, is that he was abducted and sold into child sex slavery. You've seen the documentary at this point, and I'm just curious, what are your general thoughts? Is this something that could have happened, or are we sort of running down the wrong road here?
You know, it's interesting. I did see the documentary and did some research on the case. It's one of those cases where I'm sort of two minds, and I can't decide which one's right. On the one hand, even to me as a prosecutor, some of these allegations of this ring sound a bit outlandish. And then some of the other...
Can you explain, like, in what way?
Yeah, how?
Sure. Well, we know that children being forced into sex slavery, what's often called prostitution, forced prostitution, does happen. I certainly agree with that. I've tried those cases myself. But it is unusual for it to be a teenage boy. That is an age and a gender of child that is generally not particularly compliant, and so harder to control and harder to manage. So that is typically not the target age for children to actually be abducted for something where the person wants to keep them alive and cooperating. That's why, if you look at the FBI statistics of the age of children who are kidnapped, it's mostly very young children, especially if you're talking about children who are going to be kept. Then it's even younger children, infants and toddlers, because those children can be easily controlled. But once you start getting into the teenage arena, it's a lot different. And the way that children children usually are forced into prostitution is a long process where the pimp persuades the child to join the family. The pimp provides clothing and shelter and gifts and things that these children, who are often runaways and throwaways, need and have never had before. And those sort of things just don't apply in the Johnny Gosch case. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I'm just saying it seems less likely to me than that he was kidnapped and unfortunately abused and murdered by a murderous sex offender.
Well, there are a lot of conspiracy theories out there about Johnny Gosch that we won't necessarily get into all of them, because we could, you know, talk for 8 hours here. But how do you weed through these conspiracy and leads that you get? I mean, is there a certain approach that you might take? Do you know immediately when something's false? How do you do it?
Well, of course, you have to look at everything. And that's one of the things that I was most enraged by in this case, was that the police outright refused to follow some potential leads. Whether they thought they would go anywhere or not, that's their job. And I'm talking in particular about the testimony of Bonacci. Was it Paul Bonacci?
That's correct.
Paul Bonacci. So what Paul Bonacci came forward and said was potentially true. It was also potentially false. But it is absolutely appalling to me and a complete dereliction of duty for the police not to at least go and interview someone who seemingly had some inside information about Johnny Gosch. I don't understand why they didn't do it, but that, Darren, is where you have to start. You have to just start with every lead that comes in, run them down until you determine whether or not they're legitimate. And it's a very long process when you have a missing child, because often it's exactly like it happened here. There's not really a crime scene. Where the child was taken from yields potentially zero clues. So you have to know to start with other places. For example, I want to know, did the police ever canvass that neighborhood? Did they knock on every door to say, did you see anything? Did you hear anything? That was not clear to me in the documentary that they ever even did that.
Right. And that was one of the things we definitely...
Yes.
Continually get frustrated by on our show and all the cases that we've covered. You know, a lot of these cases, there are just so many missteps with police. And do you think that, you know, it's kind of a consistent theme, do you think that this is intentional, whether it be just in this case or in general? Like, what do you think is the reason that the police wouldn't do that? And do you see this often? Like, we're talking about, you know, we've done how many episodes now? A majority of them have police missteps in them.
We always throw our hands up in the air. Like, do you think sometimes these are just, we're all human beings and you can make mistakes? Or do you usually find that there's a reason behind these missteps?
Well, that's loaded questions, guys. Loaded questions for sure.
Yes, answer all of them now with clear and concise questions or answers.
Well, do my best. You guys should think about becoming trial lawyers.
Maybe we will.
Maybe we will.
Maybe we will.
But there's no martinis during the trial, just to be clear.
Oh, we're out. We're out. We're out. Sorry.
Yeah. I thought that might be the answer.
Yeah.
No, so when it comes to these sort of cases, like just take the Johnny Gosch case as an example, I think you have police who are untrained, unprepared, don't understand the dynamics. And just to put it in perspective, this country has 18,000 different police agencies. 18,000. Now, some of those are tiny little sheriff's offices where there's literally one or two. So,
right.
And they can go all the way up to where you've got thousands of officers in the biggest jurisdictions. And it really comes down to resources and training. And a lot of these smaller police agencies don't have enough of either. And when it comes to things like child abduction and child sexual abuse and child physical abuse in particular, just recognizing those signs, understanding the dynamics, and understanding how to put together those cases takes special training that an awful lot of those police departments do not have the resources or wherewithal to get. And sadly, back in the 80s, things were even worse than they are now with that.
Yeah, no, that's such a good point. And you just really kind of opened my eyes to something I hadn't quite thought of, which is, you know, we tend, as I think, as a public, not just, I think, Darren and myself, but the public tends to generalize the word police, like all police are the same and should be doing the exact same things and have the exact same training and should react in the exact same way. But you make a great point about, you know, we're here in New York City. The NYPD is like probably one of the most trained, biggest, I'm just generalizing.
Seems that way. Yeah,
it seems that way. Generalizing. But yeah, there are places like where Johnny Gosch was abducted where maybe there's only a couple of people in that town and they don't have the same resources to get trained in the same way. Do you see a lot of that in your former work?
I do. There's no doubt that dealing with rural jurisdictions and smaller towns often means fewer resources and less training. It shouldn't. It's a tragedy, as in the Johnny Gosch case, because it often results in cases that might have been solved never being solved, because once you get past that initial evidence collection period, things grow cold, people's memories. I mean, do you remember what you ate for dinner last Monday night? I certainly don't. I'm not sure I remember what I ate for dinner last night. So these things do fade naturally, and that's the tragedy of these kinds of cases. And doesn't it often seem like they're the ones that happen in these small towns?
Yeah.
Wow, targeting. I mean, I think that is the reason that some sex offenders, and if there is some kind of a ring at work here, why they would target a small town, because they know they're freer to operate.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
That's really interesting that you said that. And a point that you brought up earlier was that Johnny seems to be, you know, he's 12 at the time. He seemed to be a little bit older than, you know, than the age of a person who would be abducted to go into these sex rings. Are there any details about this case that the average person like John and myself watching might not have picked up on with regards to the age? I mean, does this boy, Johnny, fit a certain profile for boys who get abducted? And with that, you know, what do you think? Do you think he was just abducted by some sick human, or was he abducted for a purpose?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, given my background and my experience, my best guess in this, and of course it's just a guess, but my best guess in this case is that he was abducted, sexually assaulted, and murdered all probably within a few hours. And one of the things that I think is very important evidentiary-wise in this case is the fact that a 13-year-old boy was taken not too long after Johnny Gosch from basically the same general area, and in what I really think was a dereliction of duty again. I heard that police officer who said we were never able to find any similarities in their cases, and I was yelling at Netflix.
Yes. We were too.
Yeah.
Like a crazy person, my cats looked at me. They were at home with me, and they looked at me like I was a crazy person. And of course, I really kind of am a crazy person when it comes to this sort of thing. But
yeah.
I'm yelling at the police officer because, did you see the pictures of those two boys? They could have been brothers.
Right, right.
And the similar, they were both paper boys. They were effectively the same age. Yeah.
Within the same radius, yeah.
Exactly. And so that tells me that it's most likely that a serial killer was operating in that area at that time.
So, well, first off, I'm glad you have cats. That's a big plus for me, so you're already winning.
Cats and martinis.
Yes.
our new podcast.
You know, you said that, and it was just a guess, that he was probably abducted, sexually assaulted, and murdered, you know, within, you know, a short time frame. How do you then explain what Johnny's mother said about seeing him and him showing up on the doorstep years later with this mysterious man, you know, kind of under a different identity and seemed to be under the influence or sort of held hostage? How do you justify it? Do you think that was just an illusion from the mother?
Oh, Darren, I was kind of hoping you wouldn't ask me about that.
I'm sorry.
But good question. I figured that would come up. I have to say, you know, as a prosecutor, my training was to look at everything as skeptically as possible and to see the other side before I ever went into court so that I would be prepared for whatever the other side might say and what their defenses would be in any given case. So here I tried to put aside my emotions for her because, of course, I have tremendous sympathy for Johnny's mother. She is definitely a victim in this case. And what she did and having laws changed, and she and other families, along with John Walsh, were instrumental in setting up the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. I absolutely salute her for that. So with all those caveats being said, I just hate to say this about someone for whom I have so much sympathy, but I really find that story hard to credit.
By the way, I think we all did.
We
all feel the exact same way you did. We sympathize and salute her for all of those things, but it definitely, that's why we asked you, because it seems so...
Why would she lie?
Yeah.
You know, because she is the victim here.
Well, not only did she keep it to herself for, if I'm not mistaken from what I remember the documentary, for some 2 years, she said.
Yes.
Her behavior, even her self-described behavior, mm-hmm. doesn't make any sense. If you've been missing your child for 15 years and he comes walking into your house,
right.
What would you do? I chain him there. He's never
freak out is what I would do, first off, you know, like...
Yeah.
Well, don't you call the police. Don't you call... anyone, or at least if you worry about this mysterious man that's with him, again, just doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't compute why this man would, if the man is controlling him, which was sort of implied, he would even let him talk to his mother. All of it is very hard for me to credit. But the hardest thing is that I can't imagine a mother in that situation wouldn't move heaven and earth to
yeah.
A, keep him there, or B, call someone, not necessarily the police whom maybe she didn't trust, but the FBI or neighbors or friends to follow them, figure out where they went. Did she get a license plate? I mean, I do not understand her story, and it really does not compute for me.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And just switching gears briefly, though, going back to what you had been talking about with it being in the 80s and everything, how did the technology evolve over your career with the stuff that you worked on? Because, you know, we talk about a lot of cases where, and I think you just mentioned it as well, DNA wasn't a thing until, what, the late 80s? You know, for certain.
Smaller jurisdictions longer than that,
So how did you sort of see technology evolve, and was it, did it help kind of facilitate in finding things out and helping you with your career personally?
That's a great question, John. And it has evolved incredibly. And in fact, it evolved in leaps and bounds just from when I started at the U.S. Attorney's Office in 2002 and when I left in 2012. I mean, there were tremendous advances in computer technology. And I'll just take one example that has changed the way law enforcement is forced to investigate cases. And that is the internet. The internet, podcasting, of course, yes, absolutely. But the internet has been, I think, a terrible, terrible development for child sexual abuse, and I'll explain.
Wow,
that's a big bold statement.
I know it is, right? But it's Martinez and murder. I think you make
you got to make bold statements here.
Absolutely.
Right. So back in the 90s, child pornography was largely eradicated in the United States. Mm. And it was being investigated typically in the United States by the U.S. Postal Inspection Service. And can you millennials guess why?
Oh, God. I couldn't even venture a guess.
Yeah.
Well, it's because back then, child pornography had to be transmitted through the mails.
Mail. Oh, right. That was right. What I was thinking.
I was like, that does make sense, because what are you going to, I mean, like,
that's what I assumed it was, but I didn't know if there was a deeper meaning. I just want to put that out there.
I was like, what's a government conspiracy here? Yeah. That's what I was going to.
I was just thinking to myself, you guys probably never mailed a letter, so you might not even know.
Definitely have.
What's a stamp?
We're on that verge of, like, we're millennials, but we're, like, old. You know what I mean?
Like, write handwritten letters. So you're talking to, like, actually 60-year-olds.
Right.
We just are millennials.
Perfect way to put
it. That's great. Yeah. But no, the Postal Inspection Service had largely eradicated child pornography trafficking because it was coming in and out of the United States and across state lines through the mails. Mm-hmm. So it was printed, literally printed in magazines. But then the internet exploded and technology rapidly advanced, so that now you can flash a video across the world that is a large video, a movie. You can upload it to the cloud, download it back to you in mere seconds. And because of that, child pornography dramatically changed and increased. And I think because of the easy availability of it on the internet, the way it gets traded, the way it can be stored, these horrible sex offenders, those who are sexually interested in children, can store, you know, a terabyte, 2 terabytes, 4 terabytes of movies of children being sexually abused and raped on their thumb drives or portable hard drives, that it means that so many more people can find it, so many more people can watch it, so many more people can be aroused by it. And in the social scientist's words, once you are aroused by child pornography, it is potentially just a matter of time before you want to act on that sexual interest. And so I think that the internet has caused the rise in child pornography and the concomitant rise in child sexual abuse.
And the other thing, too, is it also opens a whole market of people that are interested in it, which then turns which then turns people into, you know, criminals who are trying to maybe support that industry, if you will.
Darren, you hit the nail on the head when you say community, because that's exactly what it does. I had a case that started in Australia back in 2006, where the Australian authorities spotted an image I won't describe because we haven't had any martinis.
Yeah, please.
You would need them. But it was an image of a child being abused who also looked to be in extreme danger of being murdered. And so those authorities had never seen the images before. They didn't know where the child was or who she was. And they immediately started trying to find her. What they discovered was that her images were being, at that time, solely traded within a group made up of about 20 people who were not on law enforcement radar because they were very sophisticated in the way that they were trading child pornography, in the way they were communicating with each other using proxy servers and encryption, changing the ends of the and the titles of the images so that they were never the same as they were transmitted to and forth. And but for one particular man being arrested for molesting a child and then having his computer searched, they never would have found this group or the images of this particular child. And it took worldwide law enforcement 2 years to find her. She was in the United States in my jurisdiction outside of the city of Atlanta in North Georgia. But it took 2 years to find one child. But that community of offenders was the only community at that time that was trading her images. And they supported each other. They had emails to each other about loving the best group of pedos that have ever gathered in one place. They were proud of their sexual interests. They shared how to find kids, how to abuse kids, how to evade law enforcement detection. And so it's cases like that that tell me that the internet has been the worst thing in the world when it comes to child sexual abuse.
I just want to, I also want to follow up on that because, I mean, everything you're saying, I completely understand. And also, has there ever been a benefit to technology? Maybe because everything sort of has a trail now and there can be hackers that can find this out or, you know, making more people aware. So there's real-time updates of you find this missing person or you see something going on. Has there been a benefit of technology at all in your field?
Actually, there has, Darren. That's a great question. And in fact, the company Microsoft, along with a bunch of other partners and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, developed a tool. And that tool is effectively facial recognition software for child pornography.
Wow.
And so once you have, law enforcement, of course, keeps every image that they've ever seized from the bad guys. And those are categorized in what's called hashing. So they're given hash values, which is really just like a digital fingerprint for a photograph. And those hash values can be used to search a computer, a server, or any other device to see if there is child pornography on it and to recognize it very quickly, which enables law enforcement to know what images that have been seen and identified before and what images are new. So it allows them to concentrate on the, quote, new images so they can find those children that are being abused much, much faster and not waste their resources. And that's the other thing the internet has done. Law enforcement around the world now collaborates and shares these kinds of hash values on images around the globe so that, you know, the officer in New York City, when he sees images from one particular child being abused, doesn't start hunting her down to try to find her and spend a lot of resources looking for her when the Australians identified her 5 years ago. They know
right,
that now.
Right.
Wow.
Well, obviously, I just want to mention, as we begin to wrap up this segment, by the way, this has been a fascinating conversation.
So informative. We need to have you on.
I was thinking
all the time, Francie.
I was like, let's get her on here next week.
Happy to come on anytime.
Thank you. Well, I know a lot of parents listen to this show. I'm just curious, and I'm sure are shocked and scared as they listen to this, and I'm sure apply these thoughts to their own lives and their own children. Are there any kind of, I don't know if it's warning signs or just advice or things for parents that are listening to kind of do to protect themselves and their families from potential harm in this particular, world?
Well, there is, John. That's a great point to bring up. And there are ways that families can protect themselves and protect their kids better. Of course, I like to say that kids are their own first, best defense against being sexually abused and exploited. And so arming your children with knowledge, and most importantly, arming your children with the understanding that they can come and talk to you about anything that troubles them, something that has happened to them that they feel guilty about, that they won't get in trouble for. I cannot emphasize enough how many children are trapped in the conspiracy of silence because the offender has made them feel guilty for what they've done, or what the offender has done to them, but what the child feels that they have participated in. And so they don't tell their parent or a teacher or a school counselor. The second thing I would say is that the common misconception, because everyone wants to believe this, is that the people likely to abuse your children are going to be strangers who snatch them off the street. Of course that happens. I think that's what happened in the Johnny Gosch case. But it's much more likely that your child is going to be victimized by someone in what we call their circle of trust. About 85% of children who are sexually abused are abused by someone that they know. And so it's important for parents to keep those lines of communication with their child open, to talk about this topic, even though it's uncomfortable, and to pay attention to your child's moods. Change in behavior is the biggest indicator of a problem.
Wow. Well, that's so illuminating. And yeah, I completely am in awe of how much knowledge you have just to tell us about.
Just a quick thing. What do you think about parents who want to like implant chips into their kid to kind of, you know, GPS track them and in hopes of kind of, you know, preventing disappearances and abductions? What do you think about that?
You know, this is probably controversial, although to me it just isn't. I would not hesitate. I would absolutely not hesitate to get my child.
I'm very like, you know, I don't, you know.
As a parent, I could see it. As a kid, I would not want that, though.
Completely.
You know what I mean?
That's exactly what I mean. But the thought of, like, you know, they've been doing this with pets, okay.
Right, well.
You have to look at it from a perspective of, like, this is going to, one little thing like this could potentially keep an entire lifetime of pain and misery out of your life. Why wouldn't you do that? But that's interesting to hear your perspective, given all of your, you know, expertise.
Well, I tend to err on the side of being like a serious freak about safety. As you can imagine, all the kids in my family think that I'm a bit of a nut, and maybe I am. But that's just because I have seen the worst side of humanity and would do absolutely anything to prevent something horrible like that happening to someone I love.
Absolutely. Especially our cats, right, Francie?
Oh, you know it, Darren.
I just wanted to let that out there.
Well, I appreciate that. Just so your listeners know, I'm not a crazy cat lady. I do have a spouse at home.
I'm a crazy cat lady. In good company if you are. Just one last thing before we wrap up. If people have information that they think could lead to an arrest or a potential case, what do you suggest is the best thing for them to do? Is it simply call the police, or is there some sort of forum that they can go to?
You know, two different things. First, they can, of course, call their local police, FBI, if they think they have information that the FBI might want. And you know what? If the FBI can't have jurisdiction in the case, they'll send them to local law enforcement. But if it's child-related, they can certainly contact the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They have a website. They have lots of information on their website. They have lots of tips for parents about keeping kids safe online, for example, which is really important these days. And so I would definitely recommend that they go to missingkids.org and check out NCMEC's website, or they can always talk to their local police or prosecutor's office if they want more information. Typically, police and prosecutors go out to schools. They do a lot of speaking and training. So maybe parents want to get their PTA or their church group to host the local DA or the local chief of police to come and talk to them about these issues.
That's amazing. And we'll have all of that information in our show notes in this episode as well. So if you guys are listening at home, you can just click the notes and check out all of that information.
Francie, we cannot thank you enough for the illuminating conversation. Honestly, illuminating is probably the best word. Just, I was probably in a tailspin about this Johnny Gosch case for quite some time. I watched the documentary a year or two ago, and I've been thinking about it ever since. Yeah. And we're just so grateful and so lucky to have someone with your expertise come on the show. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. It was definitely my pleasure, guys. And I hope to have you all back on Best Case, Worst Case soon.
We would love it.
Yes, definitely check out Francie on Best Case, Worst Case, which is on iTunes, Android, everywhere you listen to podcasts. Cool. Thank you, Francie. Have a great day.
Thanks. You guys too.
Thanks.